This is the fifth day of a series of talks on estate planning, and today will be a kind of recapitulation or review of the week. So that will be helpful to those of you who just came in this morning. Personal identification, I'm Victor Hoffner, one of the consultants of the American Lutheran Church Foundation, the national offices of the American Lutheran Church, and available to the church and its agencies to disseminate information and be helpful to the individual and to congregations, to institutions, conferences, and so on. And so I consider it a great privilege to be here at Holden Village for the first time and to absorb some of the spirit that characterizes this community, especially that there doesn't seem to be any up or down, any higher or lower, but that people seem to communicate straight on, heart to heart, and a very helpful and a very congenial community. And you meet some exceptional people. Last night I met someone who is approaching 80 years old and went on an overnight hike. Not bad. It makes me feel downright lazy. And even hikes alone, either the forest, people don't know that, or Department of Agriculture and Forest, they say you're not supposed to do that, you know. But that just shows how courageous and independent and at the same time helpful people are here.
The village says that no less than three should go on a long
hike. Yes, well, I won't report her name because she had confidence in me, and I'll keep that confidence and not say who she is. She, yes. The more equal part of humankind. I can't say mankind anymore. Humankind, yeah. We're going to settle in a little bit on the very basic vehicle for estate division as most people experience it, and that is wills. We've talked about them before along the way, and so I would center a presentation along that line and then open it up to some questions. First of all, there are certain items that are deductible from the gross estate in determining the taxable estate of a U.S. citizen. And these are, most generally, according to all states and federal law, funeral expenses, various expenses incidental to the administration of the estate, losses incurred due to casualty or theft, and so forth, during the administration of the estate, the debts of the decedent, that's the person who just died, and enforceable claims against his estate. Mortgages and liens are deductible. And then there is a federal marital deduction for qualifying property passing to the decedent's spouse equal to the greater of one half of the decedent's adjusted estate or adjusted gross estate, or $250,000, whichever is the greater. The value of property transferred to or for the use of charitable, educational, religious, or public institutions, or to the government, also is deductible from the gross estate. An orphan's exclusion of $5,000, this is federal, multiplied by the difference between the age 21 and the child's age. So an orphan who would be 11 years old would be 10 years from being 21. And so the orphan's exclusion would be 5,000 times 10 years or $50,000. I believe that's a new provision in the 1976 Tax Act.
Is this the new one for 77?
Yeah.
They never had funerals before.
No.
You can never deduct funerals.
Well, you can from the federal, but you can't from some states. Mm-hmm. So some states, like I said at the beginning, I'm not able to be authoritative in 50 states or would have the time to do so. But these are really deductions, post-1976 deductions as recognized by the federal government for their for figuring the taxes, the federal unified taxes. State laws may differ, and some of these things may not be deductible in a state. Okay.
1976 is a federal report.
Yes.
And I didn't show on that.
1976. Yes,
not
but this
before
is.
1976.
No, it doesn't. This is new. You see, there is a 1976 Tax Act was passed last October, mm-hmm. and went into effect January 1st, 1977. So any estates involving a death of a person before December 31st would not find this applicable. That's correct. I thought I would just mention that there are many deductible items and that the gross estate is not taxed as such, but these expenses listed in charitable deductions, charitable contributions are that are made from the estate by direction of the will are excludable. So are there any questions from yesterday or before? I better open up to questions from some things we've passed, we've talked about, or else we'll end up without any discussion. Anything that was said yesterday or before, or a question that rose in your mind or wasn't clear or that you want further information on? If not, then we'll review some of the basic considerations in will writing. Some of you received a little sheet, one sheet, that emphasizes the getting ready to come to some kind of consensus in your family, like saying again, what is the overall goal of our life? And what are the objectives that we want to achieve in the next 5 years, 10 years, at retirement, post-retirement, to the death of the first spouse, and then after that? These sort of discussions and considerations are essential as a preparation for writing a will or rewriting a will. And remembering again that the whole purpose of a Christian stewardship is to fulfill the will of God in your life and your basic relationships, especially husband to wife, wife to husband, parents to children, children to parents, and Christian to the Lord and to his work and to the support of the Christian activities, which are valuable to those who receive them and are valuable for the weal of the community and the nation. These are things that should be taken very seriously and discussed seriously and prayed over, and decisions made which are right for the carrying out of your personal Christian ministry to people and to the ministries which Christ wants us to perform. Now, to review again some of the basic things about will writing. I'm going to just mention a few things and line them up with changes in lifetime. Some of them will be very brief. The first will be wills for young married people, no children. Is there a need for a will there? Well, the need for a will is not generally felt by very young people, perhaps because the fact that they don't have much of an estate. Perhaps what they do have, they own joint tenancy titles. And maybe many of them really just pass it off as though they don't have an estate. Contrary to this, many young people have quite a large insurance estate. And so they should write a will simply for that reason. Wills can especially express love toward one another. They can support important causes, church ministries, especially in case of accidental death of both husband and wife. What then? So many young people do not think about this, but it should be considered and be ample reason itself to write a will. Other beneficiaries could include a college, a seminary, or a ministry to the needy. It could provide for other contingencies. A will at that point could provide for distribution of estate to child or children yet unborn, yet making provision in the will for such a contingency. And then when a child is born, there would not need to be a will rewritten, because that contingency would have already been taken care of in the very first will. When should young people revise or rewrite wills? When they're moving to another state, when there's a change in a family, births, deaths, marriages, and so on. Okay, we'll call that home establishment situation. There's a second situation in life, and I mention these things even though, you know, we're more like the senior citizen type, but you have children, you have grandchildren, and perhaps along the way you'll be discussing things like this, and it will be helpful to you. A newborn child, of course, is the first person who generally gets consideration in a will of a couple that are newly parents. They should specify how an estate is to be used then for the support, for education, or even for a nest egg of such an heir, should the young parents die, predecease this child, as happens in industrial and auto accidents. So such persons should let their will express their intent for their young, and the faith. I remember talking with a pastor in Iowa who said, when young people or any parents are choosing godparents, I always say, choose somebody that you would really want to entrust your children to in case you die. Just don't honor somebody because he's a relative. Choose somebody who is very much like yourself in the values that are held, the lifestyle, someone that you could entrust with your estate to be the trustee for your child. So he said, the one that you choose to be the godparent should also be named as the guardian in your will, the very same people. Something to think about. I think sometimes we choose godparents a little bit recklessly, or just simply on the fact that they have a blood relationship or something. It's not enough. It should be someone that could serve both ways. The third bend in the river of life we might call child rearing. And a will update there would mean that you try to meet specific needs of children in will. Is one mentally, emotionally, or physically handicapped? Well, then that needs special provision in a will, perhaps a special trust for him or her reaching beyond the age of maturity. Provide guardians for all children and protect assets of trust by restricting use to life support and education. Provide for distribution of assets at full maturity only, say when the child or children reach 25 years old, not at the new low legal age of 18. Because children inheriting larger sums of money, $10,000 or $100,000 at 18, can blow it very quickly. I know of one case where a lone child, received an inheritance at 17, but he had to wait a few months until he was 18 before he could get it, and he went all the way through $200,000 in 2 years and managed to be $50,000 in debt besides. A will which would have created a trust for that child, that minor, which said that the trustee shall give to this heir only the earnings of this estate until that person is 25 years old or 27. That would have been a different story, because by that time, I imagine, he would not only have been of legal age, but would have reached some kind of emotional and mental maturity. Okay, so if people don't write wills, what happens? distribution will be made at legal age, which is very young in many states. Too young. So protect child against frivolous use of the estate. And don't restrict the use of funds simply to university education, which is often done. You know, some don't make it to university, or some can't make it at the university. Some don't want to make it at the university, but they still need education. And so it should be more broad than that, to include technical training or other kinds of training and support. If it were too restrictive, it might not serve its purpose. Marital deduction, we said before, $250,000 or one half of the estate, whichever is larger. We talked a couple days ago about the double taxation when everything goes to the remaining spouse and the estate is rather large, because then the spouse owns it, the remaining spouse owns everything, and at death the whole thing would be taxed again. So don't over-qualify marital deduction. If your estate is larger, stay to a sum of $250,000 or half of the estate, never more than that. Create some other kind of trust where income will come to your wife and there will be a distribution, perhaps a charitable distribution. If there are children, make an outright division of the estate so half of the estate goes to the children at that point if the other half is enough for the remaining spouse. If the estate is smaller and you feel that the remaining spouse needs income from the whole estate, then create a family trust with a portion of your estate so that the taxes are paid on the basis of going to your children, but the wife in this family estate will receive income from this trust as long as she lives. But at her death, then the children who already own it can claim it and use it. That way it's not taxed twice, because that way the wife, if she is the remaining spouse, has half of the estate given to her outright in the will. The other half is given to the children, but they got to wait for it, with a wife receiving income for life. Then that half is not taxed again. Where the estate is excessively large, the people may want to put in a charitable remainder trust, which is non-taxable at the death of the remaining spouse, and partially non-taxable at the time of the first spouse. If there are no heirs at all, then the options which are often open in will writing are these: that one half of the estate should be given outright to remaining spouse, the other half of the estate should be considered, and perhaps a decision made, should fund a charitable remainder trust in which the remaining spouse gets all of the income all of her lifetime, and at her death then it's distributed to charity. That way she would have the same effect for her life support as if she owned it, but there would be a tremendous reduction in the taxes. I want to say at this point that such a reduction in taxes is not accidental. This is on purpose, and it's one way that the federal government encourages support of the nonprofit institutions in America, which are very important for the continuation of our ideals in America. And many people at Capitol Hill, though some of them don't seem to have all that much ethics and morality all the time, there still seems to be a great appreciation for the institutions of the church. The charitable institutions like social service agencies, the special care centers for children, for emotionally disadvantaged people, the involvement in chemical dependency ministry to such people, the instruction in religious matters, which includes also ethics and morality, which helps to bring up a new generation that has an appreciation for what's right and what's just and what's friendly and what's helpful and so on. So it's still there, and Uncle Sam puts his hand on the shoulder of the person who gives direct gifts and says, you know, when you write out your income tax report, you can deduct your charitable contributions. And he goes further to say, if you make a deferred gift to the church by a charitable remainder trust, the charitable remainder value of that trust is deductible right now as an income tax deduction. And if it's more than you can use for this year, you carry it over to next year. And if it's more than you can use, the next year you're carried over for 5 additional years. So this is not by accident. And people who in lifetime create trusts like this, charitable remainder trust, are not chiseling on taxes. People who create trusts in their will, which has a charitable distribution at the end of the line, are not cheating the government, because through these institutions of the Lutheran Church in America, ALC, LCMS, the Presbyterian Church, Roman Catholic Church, all of those churches are qualified nonprofit organizations, and they have a value, apart from the value, as we see them as Christians, a reconciliation with God and with one another. There is a value to the whole community. I was trying to read a script this morning. I don't do very well. I always get off. But specific guardians, then back to this, the child rearing, are very important. Child launching. We mentioned in this past week several times that the federal government has made a provision for parents to help with child launching by allowing people to make $3,000 gifts per annum to a donee, or $3,000 a year, not month, a year, to as many donees as you want and can afford to give. This is called a gift tax annual exclusion. And that is one way that is left over from the 1976 Tax Act, and still remains in the new Tax Act effective January 1st, 1977, that parents can do this. And you can give it to anybody. It does not restrict the gift to children. You can give it to anybody. But it's a way that is used very often, and I think the main idea was to preserve this opportunity within the family so that there could be some nest egging. Parents could do this to help the children get launched. And you will recall, those of you who were earlier, that husband and wife can elect to gift split their gifts. That is, that it doesn't make any difference in that case whether the gift is provided by the husband or the wife. It is given as one gift, and so it's up to $6,000 per year. When husband and wife give a gift together, $6,000 per donee. Now, for a more affluent family with several children, this can be quite a big item. Because it means $6,000 to son John, another $6,000 to his wife Mary. There you got $12,000 a year already going to one group in your family tree. And if there are several sons and they're all married, or several daughters and they're married, this could be multiplied like six children all married. That's $72,000 a year. You see, you always think about Capitol Hill is just so unfeeling, you know. It's just all awful. The taxes are rigid in many cases, because they have to be to collect even anything. They have to be rigid. They have to be tough. But now this provision, I think, is really being very sensitive to the American scene and to the value that we hold of love and support and helpfulness within the family. If you want to do that in lifetime, annually, it's to gift split. You really should fill out a 709 form. That's a report of your gifts. Even though $6,000 per donee is not taxable, to be sure that you are on record at gift splitting, because down halfway down the page, it's only a one-page form, two sides to it, I believe. Right down the middle of it, there's a big capital B, and there's the gift splitting election. You fill out that line, even and file it, even though you have a non-taxable gift being made. Then
Minnesota,
you have a record.
Minnesota doesn't allow that, though.
Hmm?
Minnesota doesn't allow that.
Okay, I'm talking federal laws. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you pipe up here, because this is very important to say this again and again. What I'm talking about are federal tax laws. Mm-hmm. The state tax laws are different. And that, you're going to have to shape up, you're going to have to inquire about that. Sometimes the banks have pamphlets which give you this information. Actually, most states that I've written to in times past, they have, without cost to me, have sent me bulletins
which tell me what the state taxes are. And you could write to, each state is different, but you write to your state government and ask for a bulletin about inheritance taxes, gift taxes, so on. I think you can get one for low cost or no cost.
Is this gift giving from the income tax, current income, or is this a...
It doesn't make a difference where the source of the gift is, because the person who is generating this money in the first place must treat it as earned income or non-earned income for his own personal taxes. It doesn't reduce your taxes, but what it doesn't reduce your income taxes. But what it does do, it allows you to make a gift which is non-taxable, which would be taxable if you gave it by will and it went through your estate. It would be taxable. And under the new tax law, all the present gifts over $3,000 per year are a taxable event. There is no longer any $30,000 lifetime gift exemption federal. That's gone. So it is a taxable event if the gifts are larger than that. But that's up to the $3,000 per donee. It is not a taxable event. And then one more thing should be said, that the donee, the person who receives this gift, does not report this gift as taxable income. It's a non-taxable event to the recipient, to the receiver of the gift. So that's good news too. Okay, any other questions in this regard? Yes?
Must there be a will involved?
No.
Given with or without a will in existence?
Without a will in existence. You gift, what you do in lifetime is quite independent of your will, because you see, a will has no legal existence until you die. Before that time, it's only a plan. And I think it says in scripture somewhere, I think Paul uses argument, you see, a will is dead until the testator dies, and then it becomes alive. This is talking about our redemption and Jesus Christ. And so that our inheritance came into being by his death. So your will as a document is a dead dodo. It's nothing until you die. Then it's alive and active. That's why you should regard your wills as a revocable instrument, something that you can tear up, burn up, destroy, and write a new one. And when you do write a new will, because the old one doesn't cover the situation anymore, it's a very good idea to burn it. Absolutely destroy your old will. Because otherwise the chances are that if you have several wills, all dated and signed, and you're not that organized, that your executor might find an old will that's properly signed, properly dated, it looks like a valid will, and you start the process. And maybe there's a newer will, see? So get rid of those old wills. Now, once you've written a will, you have a plan for what should happen when you die, right? And it's if it's properly dated and signed, it's an effective instrument for the distribution of your estate. But that doesn't keep you from doing anything in lifetime. Say you made a distribution of 25% to your church organization, your home congregation, 10% to the national church body, and the rest of it is distributed to your two children. Well, that's fine. But you can change it. And if you felt constricted that you couldn't give anything to your children because it had to go by will, that's wrong. Now you could, if you became a very affluent person, say, $800,000, and you can make a distribution in lifetime. You can, even if you're poor, you can distribute in lifetime. If there's nothing there to distribute at your death, so what? The will is a live instrument without anything to kick to distribute. So nothing happened. Nothing illegal happened. You're free to do what you want to with your estate. That just takes care of what's left when you die. So you're not restricted by your will at all in lifetime. But if you have a super plan in your will, and you know that it's right for your family, and you know it's right for you not to distribute in lifetime, then you have a reason for not spending. But legally you're free. I over I think I used too much time to make this point, but it's a worthy point, because I have met people who felt so restricted because, oh, I've written my will now. Now I can't do this, I can't do that. Not so. Okay, child launching. The annual gift exclusion is a very good way to help with child launching, and it doesn't, it's not an estate or gift taxable event if you stay to $3,000 per donee. It's not an income taxable event to your child who receives this gift. It's not reported as taxable income.
How is it for the donor, though? Is it?
It's not tax deductible. In other words, it's not like if you give $3,000 to your church, you deduct it from your taxable income. You don't do that when you give a gift, because the only thing is that it's not a taxable transfer. You're not taxed for making this transfer. Mm-hmm. Whereas a transfer made through your will would be a taxable event, right?
Right. How is it for the donor, though? Is it?
It's not tax deductible. In other words, it's not like if you give $3,000 to your church, you deduct it from your taxable income. You don't do that when you give a gift, because the only thing is that it's not a taxable transfer. You're not taxed for making this transfer. Mm-hmm. Whereas a transfer made through your will would be a taxable event, right?
Right.
Okay, the empty nest. The situation changes for many people, and often to the better. Husband and wife get reacquainted because there's not that responsibility to the children, and the wife rediscovers a wonderful husband again, and the husband discovers a wonderful wife again, and this can be a great time of growing closer together. You feel, as you get older, you feel more dependent upon one another. You appreciate the fact that you have somebody who cares. Everybody's got to have one person who cares, or else life isn't worth living. And maybe it's a rediscovery of that wonderful situation where you again know better than ever how much your husband cares, and husband, you know again how much your wife cares about you. But the prospect is that the wife will outlive her husband. Something like 5, 6, 7 years, the longer life expectancy. I don't know how we are supposed to feel about that, men. But if your wife becomes especially tender toward you, maybe it's because she realizes that she's got an edge on you, and she doesn't have to fight for an edge. She's got it already, and she can afford to be kind. So this becomes a time for most people when they're still working, but their children are gone. They begin to think more seriously about retirement planning, and maybe a little bit more serious about investments for income in retirement, because that Social Security check is not going to make it for us. And so it becomes a time for making investments. Maybe for growth till 65, and then maybe reinvestments at that time for income, or half of the estate, something will keep up with inflation, the other half which will produce some good income right now. So it's a time which involves serious questions of estate planning and financial planning and so on. It may be that it's also the time to look at your will again. Has the situation changed? Are there new grandchildren that were not included in your will previously that you want to include with some special bequest? Look at your will. You may need to rewrite it. Now we come to the empty nest. Some families are different from others, and that is that it may be a second marriage. Widowers remarry. Sometimes they marry people who never were married, a woman who has never been married before, or maybe she's a widow. Each has family. Now this is an important consideration at this point, because if there is no proper will, if there are no proper wills written, it can happen that estate goes from husband to wife, and then the wife has everything, and then when she dies, it goes to her brothers and sisters. And your side of the family, oh dear husband, gets nothing. This can happen. So you have to consider this, that you write your wills where there are no children in such a way that what you agree should happen between husband and wife, and you write your wills that way, that's fine. Now, what if there are children of one marriage coming into a new marriage? Well, usually what happens then is that prenuptial agreements are entered into by these people who have been married before and do have children, which agrees that the estate of J. Henry Jones will go to J. Henry Jones' children. And the estate that is brought into the marriage by the newly wedded Mrs. J. Henley Jones, I changed the name, I believe, goes to her children of her previous marriage. And that the estate which is accumulated during this new marriage goes wherever their wills say it should go. Could be to a charitable institution, or it could be split half and half between their children. But they're like three estates, my estate, your estate, our estate. And it's very important to enter into these prenuptial agreements, which are properly authenticated, witnessed, signed, and so on. Then, when you come into rewriting your wills, you bring these documents to your attorney so that you write your will in such a way that it incorporates this kind of planning and provides for this kind of distribution. Yes?
Wouldn't that, what you're specifically stating, be regarded Minnesota law, for instance, as against California law, where there is
common property? Yeah. Well, there are a number of states who have that.
The will is more important than ever in that situation.
Yeah. A will is important also in these, like California,
Southwestern states.
Yeah, many of them have this kind of treatment. But you see, then there's the remaining spouse. Yeah. And then you still have a situation of having an estate that needs to be distributed. And so when husband and wife have previous families, then you still, this provision can be written in this law that the remaining spouse, you see, has a property and it will have to be distributed. The point is that these prenuptial agreements can become part and parcel of your estate plan as is stated in your will. So if any of you are in such a situation or know people are in such a situation, by all means, any such agreements should be brought to your attorney who is drafting your new will for you. I believe we mentioned along the week, and this is kind of a review day. So many of these things we said before this week, but this is kind of a review day, and that is, how do large bequests on the horizon affect children? And I believe I mentioned that there's one consideration, that if a very large estate, it may be a negative factor, may be detrimental. It may simply mean that the family is waiting for you to die so they can inherit more money. And so some of the more affluent people who are very keen on what parenthood means have gone to such extremes as giving their children a proper education, giving them a nest egg, or starting them out in the business, and then saying, that's it, there is no more, and the children know there's $1 million there, but the parents say, there is no more. The rest goes to my alma mater and to Luther Seminary and missions in Madagascar and Japan, and you've got your start, let's go. So no free ride, a good launching, but no free ride to the final port. Something to consider. You must know your family, you must know your situation, but there is more than money involved. There are lives involved, there are attitudes involved, there are the shaping and influencing of their present and future attitudes, etc. But it's your stewardship before God, not mine. My stewardship means to make you aware of various possibilities and principles involved. But the decision making is certainly not made by any institution. It's your responsibility. What about the people who never marry? They've got it really the easiest, I suppose, because they're free spirits that can act quite independently. But it's not all that easy. Some of the people who never marry are well-adjusted. Others who have been well-adjusted find a certain loneliness in their older age. But we can't treat all the sociological, psychological aspects of getting older alone. But it certainly is a great opportunity for a Christian, non-married person to exercise a lot of ingenuity in will writing, because they're so free to do what they want to do. They don't feel any great obligation. There are instances where, of course, parents outlive their children. I mean, in a middle-aged person who has living parents should certainly take that in consideration and should write a will which has provides for various contingencies. If my parents survive me, why not on the first line make that provision? Maybe that's the best thing an unmarried person can do. If my parents survive me, then distribution made to parents. Line item two, if my parents do not survive me, then you go on and on and on. Some of our very good contributors to charitable causes are the unmarried people. Some of the many people who participate in gift annuity agreements and lifetime, for lifetime income and distribution at death, are single people. Often professional ladies, teaching profession, a medical profession, and so on, are the ones who just almost automatically give this consideration. Divorced parents have a problem, and certainly there's no reason why they can't provide for their own natural children. And again, something like remarriage, as stated before, go to your attorney with any previous agreements that were made regarding these children, and it's quite important to do this in order to protect them in your absence. The single person we talked about in very similar situation as a widower or a widow, there's a certain freedom at that point to make decisions which you couldn't make when your spouse was still alive. The childless couple. I don't know if we have to go into great detail. As you can see, a childless couple is in a particularly different situation. One would expect them perhaps to have a larger estate because they haven't depleted their estate by child rearing and by paying for education, which is becoming very expensive now and often depletes the savings of families. But because this is Christian love and family loyalty, it becomes very important. So often the childless couple is in a better position financially, maybe not better position emotionally. But in writing a will, then comes consideration of collateral heirs like brothers, sisters, cousins, nephews, and so on. And as soon as you enter into that, you better inquire about your state laws. The inheritance taxes of various states are pretty rough on distant relatives like nephews. And many states, the tax runs up as high as 30%. And so if you combine a situation of high, I'll get to it, high state taxation for inheritance taxes with the taxes of the federal government, you could be in a situation where the distribution percentage is very small. In that case, you'd want to consider what other options are open, and you could get some help like that if you're considering charitable distribution for part of it, for income, and for distribution at the end of the line. Contact your national office of your church body. If you're, there are some Presbyterians here, so I've mentioned Presbyterians, or your particular Lutheran denominational national office. They'll give you the kind of information that you need. Question over here.
Is it basically true that a childless couple has a greater estate?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't prove that. I think it would seem that they haven't depleted their estate. I don't say it's going to be larger, but there are some people who are very modest estate. They have an adequate income, you understand, for life support. They're the kind of people who give $1,000 a year to St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, but they do not build up an estate. They help pay for the children's education. They've had a great life. They've been participating, so on, but they come to 65 without many investments. I think it's true generally that people, the childless couple, do make some kind of investments to a great extent. But the child couple with 10 in a family can be very astute throughout life and come up with a very good estate, yes. I statistically, I can't support that statement, okay? No, I don't think you could say that. You would expect that to be so, but I cannot statistically support it. Okay, so that's just running through some of the factors on wills, which we just treated happenstance as we're going along. Again, in preparation for writing a will, if you have questions relating to charitable distribution, by all means, get in touch with the with your national church office, head the national offices, and they have consultants in almost all of the churches who will go out, talk with you on the phone, write letters to you, and if possible, consult with you personally and help you to become aware of these possibilities. You will consult also with your insurance agent to provide the liquidity in your estate to pay the taxes that are going to be due, especially if you want to transfer a particular house or a farm or a business to an heir, then it's important to have the liquidity to pay the taxes so that the farm or the house or the business doesn't have to be sold to pay the taxes, in which case they're shut. So often insurance is one way to provide that cash at that moment, which will be there to pay the taxes so the business can go to Son John. I forgot my trend of thought here. Open to questions. Back there, lady in red.
I have heard of many people who are getting old and in the years to come, shortly they will be going into retirement home.
Mm-hmm.
And they have transferred their property to their children, and they take over, and the people get the homes on welfare. Is this possible to do with the property?
Yeah. I think we have two questions involved here. One is an ethical question, you know. Can you live with this or not? Some states have written some laws. Someone reported here day before yesterday, I don't know which state it is, might be Washington, I don't recall, that they have passed state laws that prohibit this kind of a situation, that you will not qualify for any charitable assistance if you have transferred your property within the last 2 years before you go to a nursing home. There will not be state funds available for support. Now, I don't know, I do not know that the federal government has passed any such laws, but it would be a logical law, wouldn't it? Okay, I think you have an ethical problem here rather than, ethical moral problem rather than a financial one. But I should say something that is close to this, and maybe it has similar ethical reverberations in it, and that is, if you had an estate of $100,000 and you are like quite old, and let's say, for instance, a person is 90 years old and he had $100,000, and he said, well, this should carry me the rest of the way, but I also want to give something to my church. If he gave the American Lutheran Church $100,000, we would return to him each year $12,000 as income. And 68% of that would be non-taxable income. Presumably, that might pay his way at a nursing home. Although, you know, the retirement situations are as low as a couple hundred dollars for an apartment to feed yourself, and then comes the dormitory situation where you may be staying here for $600 a month, and then comes the nursing care situation where it may be costing $2,000 a month or over $1,000 a month, and then maybe it's not enough. Now, what would the situation be here? In this case, if a person has entered into a gift annuity agreement with his church for income, and that income is not adequate, then that person would qualify for a charity assistance, because that person no longer owns that $100,000. All that person owns is the income from that $100,000. Now, if that's an ethical problem for you, then that's an ethical problem for you. I haven't figured out whether it's an ethical problem for me yet or not. Yes?
The gift annuity, I think, is good, and also your charitable gift, leaving the income for the widow or spouse, in case maybe for lifetime. But one thing I think should be mentioned is on estates where you're giving specific amounts, you're allowed to be in trouble both for inflation or deflation. And I personally like the percentage method better. In other words, if you got four children, give 20% to each, I mean your church, and 20% to each child,
mm-hmm.
is a much better method than, say, giving $100,000 to a child, because you may have an inflation factor before date of death, you may have a deflation, you may only have $100,000
yeah.
left, and you'd have nothing for the church and or nothing for the child.
You're talking about will writing now.
Right. In other words,
yes.
The specific amounts, I don't think are desirable.
No. When I mentioned this $100,000, I was thinking of a lifetime contract.
Right, right. That's excellent,
yeah.
too.
Now, and there, even there, you know, it's wiser to, if you want to be 100% ethical, and I think we should try to be, then it would be wiser to take, if you say you're a lone person, and you've got to take care of the rest of the way, you feel that's your personal responsibility, it might be much wiser to put $50,000 into a gift annuity agreement with the church at a high rate of return for an older person, and $50,000 in your bank. And when you can't make it from the interest from the bank and from your gift annuity, then you can pay your way out of that $50,000 that's still in the bank, and then you know you're ethical, right? Well, okay, that's just an option. I kind of laid it on you kind of heavy.
The other problem you have is with some of these foundations, sometimes they have a turnaround basis, like the Ford Foundation, for example. What Henry Ford originally set up and what it is today is two different things. And so I really like to have the idea of having the executor or executrix, as the case may be, have a list of foundations and let them decide which one to give it to on date of death.
Yes, that's also a possibility. Another possibility is very similar to that is when Christian people enter into a management trust with a trust bank. And it does not produce any kind of present income tax deductions. It does not avoid capital gains tax in funding these things. And these are factors that are real and should be considered. But it does provide the accessibility to the total assets of the estate while you are alive. And at the same time, if you don't have to deplete these assets in your lifetime, this non-charitable deduction trust, or simply a management trust with a bank, can be the vehicle through which charitable distribution is made at the end of the line. So what I'm saying here when I talk about charitable remainder trust is to make you aware of their existence and that they can be entered into in lifetime or through will, testamentary. And because other agencies don't generally mention them too much. Life insurance, people don't mention them. Trust banks generally don't mention them because very often the charitable remainder trust, they do not become the trustees, but the institution itself is a trustee. So they're against their own business, right? So no one's going to mention charitable remainder trust. That's why I mention it so often here, because in the business world, very few. An attorney now and then will mention it. A Christian attorney more often than others, or an attorney who has a close association to some other nonprofit organization which is not related to the church, very important for the community, they will be aware of it. So when I mention this all the time, I'm not making a plug for any particular institution, although I tend to come out indirectly say mentioning ALC a little oftener than but I do want to mention Holden Village. Think about Holden Village. Is this something beautiful in your life? Is this something worthwhile? Okay, when you're thinking of your charitable distributions in your will, why not? Why not make a distribution here? Okay? Now, what was mentioned before about percentage, very important, because your estate may be large, then if you have percentage distribution, it's all proportionate. Your estate may be depleted, largely it's a small estate, still the proportion of your interest and love and so on is carried out. So percentage. There is one consideration, of course, and that is where there are things that are valuable in your family, like heirlooms, which is hard to place a dollar value on, but you know that your daughter, Deborah, just is delighted with something you have in your house, and she wants it. Well, give it to her in your will. Make sure that she gets it, or give it to her in lifetime. Because if you don't, well, then there's a problem. I do want to check back a little bit with Will and talk about the guardians again. I did not mention before that when your children are talking about guardians for their children, that there's a real value in establishing these guardians by will. Because if it doesn't happen, then the court has to decide who's the guardian. Aha! His parents, her parents, they may both want to be guardian, and it may be a squabble, or they may neither one of them want to be guardian. And then the court appoints one of them guardians anyhow, and the child is disadvantaged because it's not in a place where it's especially welcome. I know that's a hard word to say, but we got to say these things because they do happen sometimes. So, very important. Any other questions? We've got about 3 minutes, is that right, to go? And this is the first time we're ending on time, maybe. Back there with a blue
Have you raised any question or discussed buying your cemetery lot and making arrangements with your mortician?
Well, that could be stated in your will, yes. And
ahead of time, even before the will.
Yeah. Some people prefer to put this with their will as a request, or if there's a contract. Some people enter into contracts for their burial in lifetime. And such information should be available to a close relative so that these things are known.
My point is, with the extreme inflation, it's much cheaper to make the arrangement now than to wait another 10 years and the cost may be 20% more.
Yes, that's a good point. That's a good point, but where are you going to die? I know someone who died in Amsterdam. And it cost a fortune to get the body back, to get it to that plot, which cost only $150. It would have been much cheaper to bury that relative at Amsterdam. But when you have a contract for burial and you've got a plot and everybody feels you've got to get home, or say you have you're living in Phoenix now, and you have a plot there, but you decided to live in South Carolina later on, then... And you have a contract with that mortician over there in Phoenix, and you are in Greenville, South Carolina. It could be more expensive, I think, to get you back to Phoenix than to be buried in Greenville. I'm not saying no to what you're saying. I'm just saying there are other considerations. I know this because we've been thinking about ourselves. You think, we don't have a plot. And if we could decide where we're going to die, we would buy one right away.
The arrangements with the mortician are transferable, depending upon if you live.
See, that's a good point. And if you're entering into a contract with a mortician, that's something you should be looking for. Something that's transferable to another mortician in another location. Excellent. Any other good ideas? Yes?
There's memorial gardens all over. So mm-hmm. if you have a lot in one and you move to another state that has a memorial garden, you can transfer your...
Okay, some more valuable information. That's great. Look into these things when you enter into contract. See what options are open to you, whether it's a good contract for you or not. If there are no more questions, it's just exactly 10:15, and it's been a great experience to be with you. And if you want to ever get in touch with me again, write a letter to 422 South 5th Street, Minneapolis.